From the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This week we're broadcasting from the studio at Center for American Progress in Washington, D.C. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. You know, as I look around the intersection of religion, government, and politics from which we broadcast, the view is actually horrifying. Strewn with the debris of political brinksmanship, the landscape is covered with shards of shattered stained glass, shreds of the Constitution, and the jagged edges of broken promises. It's both easy and accurate to lay much of the blame for all of this at the feet of the House majority, which came to power on a wave of populist discontent fueled by limitless campaign dollars and widespread media irresponsibility. Meanwhile, TV news ratings are way up since the government shut down. You know what that means? More advertising dollars. So how eager do you think media executives are to see a resolution to all of this? A resolution that would be good for the nation, but damaging to their bottom lines. You talk about a broken system. But you know what? I'm done feeling bad for the president and congressional progressives who claim helplessness in the face of conservative intransigence. Their jobs were never meant to be easy. Yes, there is dishonesty and irresponsibility and a well-organized and well-funded opposition. And so what? Our representatives, men and women who were elected to shepherd the values and priorities of mainstream Americans in Washington, need to find a way to do their jobs. They need to be relentless masters of rhetoric, strategy, and tactics. Look, members of our armed forces lay everything on the line to defend the country. Police, fire, and other emergency personnel put their lives at risk in the course of their heroic work every day. And it's time to demand nothing less of the allegedly sane caucus on Capitol Hill. No more excuses. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
This is about the happiest I've seen members in a long time.
We have to get something out of this, and I don't know what that even is.
This fight now has become about veterans and about National Guard folks that perhaps reservists that are not getting paid.
What the hell did you think was going to happen when you shut down the government?
When you look at the recent seemingly crazy days in our nation's capital, the government shutdown, the frenzy over the Affordable Care Act, the imminent debt ceiling crisis, it would be easy to think either that the situation has been blown out of proportion by a ratings-hungry media or that our leaders really have lost their grip on sanity. After all, within the absolutist brinksmanship we're told is playing out, there are very real risks to both the U.S. economy and to individual political careers. It makes you ask, why would politicians take such enormous chances? It truly makes no sense, unless one is willing to entertain the possibility of a very, very large plan playing out in the halls of power, of agendas larger even than the Affordable Care Act or the stability of the dollar as an international currency. Most of us would dismiss such speculation as misguided conspiracy theories. This past week, however, a remarkable number of highly respected writers has begun to convincingly connect the dots and present remarkably consistent conclusions. In the Huffington Post, for example, Morgan Guyton, Peter Montgomery, and Frank Schaefer are among the prominent voices making similar points. And award-winning journalist Chris Hedges lays it out in a column for TruthDig.com. The time has come where we have to address this, and we will, when Chris Hedges joins me later on this week's show.
American Jews overwhelmingly say they are proud to be Jewish, but one in five Jews now describe themselves as having no religion.
Last year at this time, the Pew Religion and Public Life Project was making headlines with a comprehensive study revealing that a fast-growing percentage of Americans consider themselves to be religiously unaffiliated. We saw the birth of the shorthand label, the Nones, N-O-N-E-S. Now, Pew has just released an overview of Jewish identity and religious practice in this country, and the results are no less surprising. On this week's show, we'll talk about those results with Greg Smith, director of U.S. Religion Surveys at the Pew Research Center. But first,
there's been prayer in Congress and in state governments for more than 200 years. So the Supreme Court's decision to weigh the legality of prayer at government meetings could have big implications.
With so much media attention on the gridlock paralyzing the legislative and executive branches of government, it has served as a distraction from the start of something very important, the start of the new Supreme Court term, where the justices are very likely to rule on several cases critically important to matters of religion, government, and politics. Most immediately, the court has agreed to hear Town of Greece versus Galloway, a case involving prayer at town meetings in a small upstate New York community. Joining me now in the studio to discuss this is Religion News Service national correspondent Lauren Marco. Lauren, we're not going to do a prayer before we do the interview, so welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you would, start by just briefly summarizing the Galloway case.
Surely. The Galloway case begins in Greece, New York, which is a suburb of the city of Rochester, and it has to do with the town's practice at their monthly meetings of beginning every one of those meetings with a prayer. Now, over the years, it has been noted that those prayers have been given only by Christian pastors. And when some members of the community complained, they threw in a Wiccan priestess and a Jewish man, not a rabbi, and tried to mix it up a little, and then went back to solely Christian prayers, many of them very sectarian, praying in Jesus' name, etc. Two women who were offended by the practice, Galloway and Stevens, one a Jewish woman, one an atheist, went to Americans United for the Separation of Church and State, and they all together sued. They said, this is way too coercive, and this is way too sectarian, and they lost in federal court. And they appealed, and then they won in circuit court. And the Supreme Court, much to the surprise of many who follow religion cases, has agreed to hear the appeal and consider this case, and that will be done on November 6th.
My guess would be that a lot of our listeners thought, well, that could be our town, because it goes on in a lot of communities, and I think in the South probably even more than in the Northeast or some other parts of the country. So this is it's a significant case. My interest is right off, why did the Supreme Court take this case right now?
Well, many people are asking this question because this case seems so particular in some ways. And one of the answers may be that the question of legislative prayer, can you begin the meeting of a government body with a prayer, has not been considered in 30 years. We have to go all the way back to 1983 in a case called Marsh versus Chambers, in which a legislator in Nebraska said, you know, we shouldn't be opening our legislative day with a Christian prayer every day, and we have an in-house chaplain. He's Presbyterian, and it's always this guy, and let's not do that. He lost 30 years ago, and the precedent was set. Legislative prayer is okay.
Mm-hmm.
Just you have to meet two conditions. One, you can't be very coercive and proselytize. You can't put down another religion.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of intimated you shouldn't be too sectarian.
Hmm. Well, I think is those are the two criteria for doing prayers in a lot of communities because they don't want diversity, right?
It seems as if in some communities there's this is the way we do it, and to heck with the rest of you attitude.
Right.
Others have been advised by their town councils, who really don't want to defend the town or city in a lawsuit, to mix it up a little. Let's bring in somebody else. Let's at least invite the rest of the community to come in. And let's be a little careful in choosing our words. And maybe let's not say Jesus. Maybe let's say God. Maybe let's invoke a deity in general. But let's at least give the appearance of trying to be inclusive. And those communities tend not to get in the same trouble as Greece did.
Yeah. So I don't know whether you brought your crystal ball or not, but given the makeup of the court we now have, what's your guess on it?
Well, I'll just accumulate the guesses I have heard from other people who are much more expert in this particular case.
Okay.
And on both sides, the prediction is that the separation of church and state people are not going to win this one, that Greece is going to prevail, and that the Second Circuit's decision is going to be struck down. The question is how narrowly or how broadly.
You know, what strikes me as somewhat ironic is the Supreme Court takes this case. They may already be somewhat inclined, as you've just said, in this particular court to rule in favor of the legislative prayer. But the fact that they're even looking at it when just not very far from them every day, the House and the Senate open with a prayer from a chaplain or someone the chaplain has invited to do the prayer in Congress. So folks can't be blamed for seeing some disconnect here. How would you explain that to them?
Sure. It does. It does look strange.
Yeah.
It's okay in Congress, but it's not okay in this small town. And here's what the plaintiffs have said. They're not saying Congress can't do that. They're saying Greece can't do that. What's the difference? Well, the argument is that the congressional chaplain is there for Congress, not for the whole country. The chaplain is supposed to advise and pastor to members of Congress, and when the opening prayer is made every morning, that the chaplain, who happens to be a he, is praying for members of Congress, and they can't feel a sense of coercion because they hire the guy, and they pay him.
Mm-hmm.
It's different, they say, in the town of Greece, where children come to town council meetings and people who want liquor licenses and want zoning variances and new police officers who need to be sworn in before the council have to be there. Their presence is required. And when a prayer is extremely sectarian and they are not members of that religion, they will necessarily, they say, feel excluded and as if they're second-class citizens because they don't agree with the invocation before them.
Mm-hmm.
So they say it's different in Greece. It's a smaller community, and the prayer is often stated in different terms the way it is in Congress. It's often, pray with me, or let us bow our heads together. And it is very noticeable who is bowing and who seems to be a part of this prayer and who doesn't. If you look at the gallery of visitors in the House of Representatives or in the Senate, in Congress, nobody's looking what the people in the gallery are doing. They don't want anything from Congress that day. They're not petitioning anything. So if they don't participate, it's not going to change their lives.
Mm-hmm.
But the people in Greece who are waiting for a decision on their zoning variance may think, ooh, if I don't really show I'm part of this prayer, that might affect me adversely.
Yeah, I see that. it seems to me that there is a principle here that would be applicable. I personally don't think it should start with a prayer, but if it were starting with a prayer, it should at least be prayers that reflect the diversity of the community in which it's being held. I think it's encouraging that the court rejected a challenge to an appeals court ruling regarding sexual activity between consenting adults in the Commonwealth of Virginia. And, Lauren, I know that this is early in a Supreme Court term, but there are a lot of variables in what cases the justices choose to address. Is there any way to predict if the court will hear cases that have been filed addressing abortion and birth control issues this term?
Well, it looks like we're going to get a couple. It looks like we're going to get two abortion cases, one about a law in Massachusetts that restricts protests outside of clinics, and another, I believe it's from Oklahoma, could be Colorado, so don't quote me on this, about abortion-inducing drugs. Mm-hmm. And then, though we don't know for sure, it looks likely that there will be a case on the contraception mandate, perhaps what people are calling the Hobby Lobby case, where that Christian-owned business is protesting the mandate. They don't want to have to pay for health insurance for contraception or abortifacients, as they call them.
Do you know of other issues that the religious community in particular is going to be interesting in that may come up this term?
I think those are the main three. The court needs four votes to grant cert and five votes to make a decision. So it's always interesting when a case is granted cert. We don't know what the justices who did that, who were in the four, had in mind. Some of them may have very different motivations than others, which is why this is such a guesswork kind of game.
Is there anything likely to come forward on the faith-based initiative and federal funding of religious movements?
You know, I haven't seen anything. It doesn't mean it hasn't. It's not going to happen, but that's something I haven't seen bubbled up. And it could be that I just haven't paid attention to that. Okay. Nothing
I've
seen
so far. What
about
anything else from the LGBT community?
The LGBT community, we have major decisions handed down in June. I think those are people are going to see what happens with those. The next front on LGBT cases could be an employment law, because in so much of the country, you can be fired for your sexual orientation, or hiring and firing decisions can be made just on that basis. So we could start to see some cases along those lines, and it'd be interesting to see if those get to the Supreme Court.
And also the religious exemption. There's some cases, I think, that may get in the pipeline on that. Well, you have an interesting job in watching all of that and reporting on it. Lauren Marcot is national correspondent at Religion News Service. RNS, as you know, is an invaluable resource, a secular news service covering religion news exclusively for over 75 years. You can follow Lauren's work and all of the journalists at RNS online at religionnews.com. Lauren, thank you for coming by the studio today, and you're always welcome on State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Later in today's show, an eye-opening new study from Pew Religion and Public Life Project on the rapidly changing sense of identity among Jewish Americans. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio. There's nothing unfairly partisan about pointing a finger at one political party in criticizing the latest government shutdown. One political party has harbored politicians who overtly denigrate the very concept of government as a force for good. That same party harbors a number of elected leaders who overtly campaigned with promises of shutting down the federal government. attaching those promises to Obamacare, to funding for Planned Parenthood, to the federal budget, confounding Democrats and mainstream Republicans, a chaotic gaggle of Tea Party legislators, is in the process of radically redefining our national politics by doing exactly what they promised to do. Well, you may well ask, how can such a destructive agenda make sense? A number of respected analysts have spoken out in recent days suggesting that the reason it doesn't make sense is that while it's easy to see what's being torn down, it's not yet visible what's being built in its stead. A particularly well-respected voice on this issue belongs to Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Chris Hedges. I well remember almost eight years ago in January, I sat down with Chris Hedges, and it was the first interview that I ever did on State of Belief Radio. I remember that the microphone looked like it was catching on fire, and he is still speaking just that way with truth and with passion. And Chris, I am so glad to have you with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you.
What do you say is the backstory to the whole government shutdown? Who's gaining from this?
This has long been the goal of the radical Christian right that draws on dominionism or Christian reconstructionism, and that goes all the way back to ideologues such as Roussas Rushduni and others. They seek to reduce government to internal security, defense, and the protection of property rights, and they look at all of the other functions of government as impediments to the creation of a Christian state. They see, for instance, the Department of Education as propagating, and this is their view, the ideology of secular humanism. And for them, government, with the exception of those three areas that I mentioned, is a force that is, you know, aligned in their extremist rhetoric with the Antichrist and has to be destroyed. And so you are seeing this ideology being expressed on the House floor. Its most visible figure is, of course, Senator Ted Cruz, who comes out of this tradition. His father himself is a pastor in this mold. And I think that the wider public hasn't grasped the ideological roots, nor the fact that the destruction of government, and they have, in essence, found the weapon to do it, has long been part of their game plan and is something that they rejoice in rather than see as a temporary evil. They see government as something that largely has to be abolished, and they have found the weapon, the mechanism, to essentially do just that. And in that sense, I'm very frightened because I don't think we're dealing with rational people here. I don't think this is just a tactic. I think this has a long ideological history rooted in the radical Christian right. And I think when they say that this is their goal, I take them very seriously.
Chris, not all of our people understand what dominion is and how that arose. I want to ask you, if you will, to talk a minute about that. And then I want to ask you to connect the dots between that kind of philosophy and what we're seeing happening right now.
Well, dominionism is a very peculiar ideology. They will refer to themselves as evangelicals or fundamentalists. That's a misnomer. I mean, traditional evangelicals take the old Baptist church. While they would be conservative on social issues, at least before they've been reconfigured, they were often, you know, allied with the working class and social policies. Mm-hmm. You always had a break between fundamentalists and evangelicals, indeed fundamentalists, who always called on believers to remove themselves from the contaminants of secular society, shun politics, even Billy Graham, after getting too close to Richard Nixon, talked about keeping politics at arm's length. Dominionism is about the fusion of the nation with the Christian religion, the belief that believers are called to create the Christian state to prepare the way for Christ to return. So it flips millennialism on its head. It's not that Christ comes back to create the kingdom. It's that we create the kingdom for Christ. I mean, that's where it comes from. But what it really is about achieving state power. And for the last couple decades. That has been the goal of Dominionists, of Christian Reconstructionists.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a significant foothold now in the House of Representatives, although a minority. They have been able to use this technique to essentially shut down the government.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that has been preached by Dominionists for a long time, that government is an evil that has to be destroyed, that education and social services should be turned over to the church. They see themselves in an ideological war, and they see the secular institutions within the wider society and within the government as propagating an ideology which is antithetical to their very peculiar version of Christianity. And it's a kind of binary view of the world, black and white, good and evil. That's where they're coming from. That's what they see. And I think that we talk about the Tea Party, we talk about the conservative wing of the Republican Party without grasping their belief system, which I've read and I know which you know as well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my book was called American Fascist, Christian Right.
Right
and the War on America. I mean, I see it as replicating in Christian garb the ideology of fascism, complete with, you know, the hyper-masculinity and everything else that always comes with fascism.
Chris, do you see Senator Ted Cruz as a Dominionist?
Yes, without question, yeah.
And you said this is at least in part due to his background?
Yeah, I mean, he comes out of that tradition. His father is one of the stalwarts.
Why is the media so reticent to tell us about it?
Because they don't understand it. You know, having spent 15 years working for the New York Times, they are willing to accept the kind of religious veneer that this movement puts upon themselves at face value without actually exploring their belief system. So
mm-hmm.
they describe them as conservative Christians, when in fact I think they're something very different and something very dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in liberal secular newsrooms like the New York Times, there's at once a kind of disdain for all religiosity of any type, coupled with the fact of no real background, no real understanding of theology itself or various forms of Christian belief. They just don't know it. And so I think that a lot of it comes out of ignorance. And of course, Weldon, as you know, I am a seminary graduate and grew up in the church. But I think when I worked at the New York Times, I was probably the only seminary graduate in the newsroom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I can honestly see how someone from a sheer secular perspective would say, surely they're not serious about this. This seems unbelievable.
I think that's the biggest mistake people are making, that they're not serious. And I think that the reason that they can write them off is that they don't actually understand their formation and what it is they believe and mm-hmm. how they look at the world. And that takes, you know, a lot of investigation and a lot of work, because they speak one way to the wider society and to the public and another way to themselves. And
mm-hmm.
one has to get inside these movements, as I did, and see what they're saying amongst themselves to understand that this deep antipathy to government, to secular society, to liberal democracy even is very, very real. And
mm-hmm.
now, of course, we are seeing its expression.
In reading your latest Truth Dig article, I was reminded of a quote from Karl Popper that you included at the beginning of your book, American Fascists. If we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. How do you see that as relating to the situation that we're facing today?
I think that that quote is very apt. These are people who seek to work within a system only because they have to. Their goal is to destroy the system, and they're doing a pretty good job of it right now. And once they don't have to work within the system, they intend to eradicate all elements within the society that don't conform to their ideology, whether that's the school system, the press, people like us who they would condemn as nominal Christians because we don't embrace their belief system, government departments, from education to labor to everything else. They are quite, quite serious about using every tool at their disposal to reconfigure the society and use all institutions, in essence, as forms of indoctrination.
Mm-hmm. What would be the long-term consequences of President Obama giving in to the current extremist demands of the Tea Party?
Well, this is a movement that has been burrowing into the political system now for a couple decades. I think it's a movement that would need a crisis in order to actually come to power. That could be a manufactured crisis. They may indeed be able to manufacture the crisis that swells their ranks. But the more that the self-identified liberal mainstream is discredited and rendered impotent, the more persuasive their argument becomes and the more powerful they become, and that's certainly their goal.
Mm-hmm.
So they're quite willing to slash and burn, to carry out a quite vicious campaign. And I think that a lot of people have read it wrong by saying that it may backfire on sort of more mainstream Republicans like Boehner, but for those people like Cruz, who are in the heart of that movement, they're certainly going to be seen as heroes.
Yeah.
And let's not forget that they're very heavily bankrolled. There's a lot of money behind them.
Talk about the synergy between dark money special interest groups and the Dominionist faction. Where do their agendas converge?
Well, you have powerful right-wing corporate entities that have converged with the Dominionists in that they seek to weaken government and government control, government regulations that prevent monopolies, government tax systems, and so the large sort of corporate finance packs that were at work in the last presidential election have now been able to funnel their resources into this movement, not because I think they embrace the ideology, but because they see the goals of this movement as something that converges with what their own self-interests are.
Mm-hmm.
In the long
mm-hmm.
run, of course, they're very foolish. I mean, we saw this in the rise of fascism in Germany, where the German industrialists backed the Nazi Party and didn't understand what they'd done. And I think in a similar kind of way, these people are so unplugged from reality that even those business interests and corporate interests that are bankrolling them at this moment, you know, should they come to power, will one day deeply regret it.
Yeah. I think it's fair to say that most Americans are not ready to believe how comprehensive the changes that some of these folks have in mind actually are. I'm curious, do you think that even the Democrats and the Republicans in Congress truly understand what has hit them?
No, I think that they don't understand. And I covered the war in Yugoslavia. These figures are often dismissed as buffoonish in the way that Radovan Karadzic was and others. I think people look at them as, correctly, as slightly unhinged, but don't understand how deadly a force they are. And I think that, you know, history has repeated that mistake. And let's be clear, I mean, our liberal mainstream is very anemic and very weak and very impotent and largely discredited because of that. Again, replicating what I saw in Yugoslavia, or you can go back to Weimar. And should there be any kind of a collapse or crisis, you may very well replicate the scenario that happened in Yugoslavia, where that weak sort of traditional liberal center was utterly discredited because of the crisis, and people turned to these very frightening figures that were sort of vomited up on the fringes of society. But yes, I think people don't understand. They don't take these people seriously.
Yeah.
In the same way that in Yugoslavia, the rabid ethnic nationalists like Slobodan Milosevic were not taken seriously. And history has shown that that's a very big mistake.
Talking within the context we're talking about right now, if you had a minute to get the president's ear, what would you say to President Obama about what we're talking about?
Well, I mean, I came to the conclusion, it's not a particularly original one, that the only way to fight this movement is to reintegrate those disenfranchised believers back into the economy, that we're not going to be able to argue with them rationally. And the longer chronic underemployment and unemployment and job insecurity continue, the more the economy unravels, the more these frightening deformities find credibility in a collapsing society. And so we're not going to argue them out of their ideology. But the failure on the part of the Obama administration to deal with the foreclosure and mortgage crisis, to create a serious jobs program, to unburden our college graduates from this debt peonage that is destroying their lives, to create universal health care, these are the kinds of things that will actually be the best mechanisms to break these fanatic movements. And if we don't do that, then these movements are only going to grow.
Chris, you want to make a prediction about how this ultimately will play out, or is the genie out of the bottle now? And even if it all gets sorted out this time, is it only a matter of time before the stakes are even higher and the same tactics are brought to bear once again?
Well, it's clear that if they don't succeed this time, they will try again. But, you know, there's no sign, I'm watching this from a distance, there's no sign that anybody's going to move. They may do something about the debt ceiling, but they paralyzed the government, and they're very happy about it. And at least at this moment, it doesn't look like they intend to concede.
Mm-hmm. Chris Hedges is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. He's reported from over 50 countries, and his books include American Fascists, The Christian Right, and The War on America, and most recently, Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt. He is a fellow at the Nation Institute. Chris Hedges, this is really frightening stuff, but it's essential for us to look at it honestly and unflinchingly, because the problem, as you just said, is not going away. You do such good work, Chris, and I thank you for it, and I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Weldon.
Last October, we were all talking about a major study just released by the Pew Religion and Public Life Project. That study revealed the rapidly growing number of Americans who identified themselves as nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the religiously unaffiliated. This year, Pew has again made headlines with a study that again suggests a notable shift in the way a religious group relates to its religion. Titled A Portrait of Jewish Americans, it contains plenty of surprises, and I'm very pleased to be joined now by Gregory Smith, Director of U.S. Religion Surveys at the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project. Dr. Smith, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you for having me.
What were some of the specific findings of the Jewish study that got everybody talking about it?
What really jumped out at me is that some of those larger societal trends that you described, the growth of people who say they have no religion, are really reflected among this community, among Jews in the United States. What the survey shows is that among the Jewish population in the United States, about one in five Jews can be thought of as Jews of no religion. That is, they are people who, when we ask them about their religion, we say, with what religion are you associated? They tell us they have no religion, that they are atheist or agnostic, or that they are nothing in particular with respect to religion. They then go on and tell us, however, that they do think of themselves as Jewish aside from religion, and furthermore, they were raised Jewish or had at least one Jewish parent, but their connection to Judaism today is more a matter of ancestry and culture than it is of religion. The remaining number, about 8 in 10, are people who are Jews by religion. That is, people, when we say, what's your religion, they describe themselves as Jewish.
Hmm. It's curious to me that the 1 in 5 would still want to identify themselves as Jews rather than just saying, we don't have a religion.
Well, I think one of the things that's very important to point out, and that is certainly illustrated in the study, is that being Jewish is not primarily, is not necessarily a matter of religion. Many Jews tell us that they think of being Jewish as mainly a matter of ancestry or culture. In fact, 6 in 10 Jews tell us that being Jewish is mainly a matter of ancestry and culture. Only 15% tell us that it's mainly a matter of religion. And that's one of the things that was really unique about this study. Certainly from my perspective and from our perspective institutionally, you know, we've done many studies of religious groups. We've done studies of Muslim Americans. We've done studies of Mormons. We've done lots of studies of evangelical Christians and Catholics. This is the first study I've worked on where the focus wasn't, say, merely a religious group, so to speak, but it was a religious and ethnic group.
Did you see differences between the various movements of Judaism, and also did you see differences that were tied to age?
Absolutely. There are some very significant differences depending on the particular denominational stream with which Jews identify. One way to think about it is to kind of begin by thinking about Jews as a whole. If you think about Jews as a whole with respect to their overall level of religious observance, they tend to be somewhat less religious than the general population in the United States and then other religious groups. Socially and politically, Jews as a whole tend to be quite liberal and democratic in their views. But Orthodox Jews, who constitute about 10% of the Jewish adult population in the United States, Orthodox Jews are really quite distinctive in those measures. Orthodox Jews are among the most religiously observant groups, not just among Jews, but in the U.S. population as a whole. They also tend to be more conservative and Republican as compared with other Jews. There are some very significant differences by age. Perhaps chief among them, young Jews are among the most likely to say that they are Jews of no religion. If you look at the different generational groups, among the oldest generation, among the greatest generation, people who came of age during the World War II years, if you look at that community, only about 7% are Jews of no religion. The vast majority, upwards of 9 and 10, are Jews by religion. But among the youngest generation, among Jewish millennials, fully one-third are Jews of no religion. And that's very similar to what we see among the general population, where we see young people, the youngest generation, really driving the growth of the nuns. You see the same thing among Jews.
What areas of Jewish life and identity in this country have changed the fastest over, say, the past decade?
We do know that on a couple of measures of religious observance, like having participated in a Seder at Passover and like having fasted at Yom Kippur, those practices seem to have ticked downward a little bit over the last decade. But there's other things that haven't changed very much. Among those is attachment to Israel. Most Jews, 7 in 10, tell us that they feel at least somewhat emotionally attached to Israel, and that really hasn't changed much over the past decade or so.
I have a sense that there are a lot of people in the Christian community that have merged cultural mores and traditions with Christian mores and traditions and probably would identify as a Christian, but it may be much more culturally defined that way than it would be by doctrine or so forth.
I don't think there's any question at all about that. Even when we look at very basic measures like frequency of religious attendance, we find many Christians, Catholics, evangelicals, mainline Protestants who tell us that they don't attend church particularly often. There are many Christians who tell us that, yes, I'm Christian, but, you know, religion isn't really that important in my life. Christians are more likely than Jews to say that they attend religious services regularly or that religion is very important in their lives. But there's by no means unanimity among Christians on those questions, just in the same way that there isn't among Jews.
Yeah. Is there a way to compare some of your findings about Jews in this land with the Jewish population globally?
We've done some of that. We do look, for example, in this survey at the opinions of American Jews on questions about settlements in the West Bank, for example, and how that compares to Jews in Israel. And what we find is that Jews in the United States are a little bit more skeptical about what those settlements are accomplishing, but we're pretty limited in the number of those kinds of comparisons we can make. We do know the big majority of the world's Jewish population resides in either Israel or the United States. Our demographic analysis suggests that about 40% of Jews live in the United States and about 40% live in Israel.
Dr. Smith, you've been about this for a while. What surprised you the most in this survey?
The differences that we see between Jews by religion on the one hand and Jews of no religion on the other. We talked a little bit about the relative size of those groups and how the ranks of Jews of no religion have been growing. But one of the things that was so striking to me is that on a variety of measures, Jews of no religion are far, far less connected to Jewish institutions, far less attached to the Jewish community, and far less likely to say that being Jewish is a key part of their lives as compared with Jews by religion. Jews of no religion are much less likely to be married to a Jewish spouse. Jews of no religion are much less likely to be raising their children Jewish as compared with Jews by religion. We find a very consistent pattern across all the questions we ask, and it's really quite striking, and I think raises real questions about Jewish continuity in the United States. Okay, so there is a large group of Jews who continue to identify as Jewish, even though not by religion. But I think it's an open question as to how strong that attachment is and their children's attachment to Judaism might be. We'll have to see moving forward, but the data certainly suggests that that's something to keep an eye on.
It strikes me that maybe one of the most important derivatives of this survey is that there are long-term ramifications of the level of assimilation that you are documenting in your poll. Would you say that's true?
Absolutely. I think that's right. And I know that this has been a question of longstanding concern and interest to the Jewish community. But yes, the survey certainly suggests that movement away from attachment to the Jewish community by virtue of religion, that intermarriage, that these kinds of things are related with other indicators of involvement in Jewish institutions and the Jewish community.
Mm. Dr. Gregory Smith is director of U.S. Religion Surveys at the Pew Research Center's Religion and Public Life Project. It has just released this new report titled A Portrait of Jewish Americans. It is available online at www.pewforum.org. Dr. Smith, I hope that you know and your colleagues know that the work that you all do in this polling data about various religious groups is extremely helpful to those of us who care about religion in the nation. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, that's very, very kind of you to say. I appreciate it, and thank you for having me.
Now, before we go, I want to highlight something else that happened this past week in Washington, D.C. 8 members of Congress were arrested and hauled off to jail on Tuesday. No, it wasn't for the criminal shutdown of our government and the pain inflicted on millions of innocent Americans. No, it wasn't for the profoundly irresponsible failure to contain the extremist forces shredding our government and our nation. But it was for putting themselves on the line in the service of a cause they believe in, comprehensive immigration reform. You remember that? For civil rights icon Representative John Lewis, age 73, it was his 45th arrest. Luis Gutierrez, Keith Ellison, Raul Grijalva, Joe Crowley, Al Green, Jan Schakowsky, and Charlie Rangel were also among more than 200 people arrested in total, including faith leaders, members of advocacy groups, and other activists. It happened Tuesday afternoon on the National Mall, away from the floor of the House and its endless yielding of 15 seconds to the gentleman from blah, blah, blah. The arrests were a reminder of what it looks like when committed Americans, despite being elected to public office, are able to put themselves on the line for something they and the voters they represent believe in. And it's time we demand that level of commitment from the men and women we elect to represent each of us. If the opposition is better organized, we need to admit to past failures and get better organized. If the opposition is better funded, we need to admit to past failures and become better funded. It's not always the best ideas that win. It's the ideas about which people care the most passionately that win. And for each of us, it has never been more important that the ideas we care about are the ideas that are cared about most passionately. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. State of Belief Radio is made possible in part by the generous donations of listeners like you. Please visit us online at stateofbelief.com and consider making a financial contribution to our work today. We'll use it wisely. We'll keep State of Belief on the air and expand the reach of this program at a time when so few voices representing an inclusive, respectful approach to interreligious dialogue seem to exist. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can find out more about the show, hear extended interviews, watch in-studio videos, read transcripts, and sign up for our podcasts. You'll find more information about the topics discussed on this week's show and resources to help bring State of Belief to a radio station near you. Stay in touch with us, please. Stay in touch throughout the week. Use Facebook, use Twitter. There's also contact information available at stateofbelief.com. The listener line is 800-856-0277. As always, we encourage you to tell others about the show so they will join us and listen and then join us in conversation. I want to tell you that Ray Kirstein, our great producer, is enjoying his third anniversary on this show. I think it's the longest that a producer has stayed with us, and I have to say that he is an excellent contribution to this show. Join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see, Welton.